Welcome to the Coin Podcast Network.
A family of five takes a Sunday drive and vanishes.
Well, has anybody seen or heard anything today? Try and get any kind of information. Nothing was going on.
One detective refusing to accept the official story.
It's much, much harder to substantiate accident theory than it is the foul play theory.
More than six decades later, the mystery endures, and the question remains.
This kind of thing just really didn't happen. It was always a mystery.
What happened to the Martin family?
When we find the car in the Columbia River, we will find the Martin family, and we will solve this case.
Hello, I'm Ian Costello, and welcome to this special presentation from the Coin Podcast Network. 62 years after a Portland family vanished in the Columbia River Gorge, Coin 6 News anchor Jeff Gianola and I sat down with author J.B. Fisher to talk about the case. Over the course of 9 months and several conversations with Fisher and others, Jeff and I put together this story on the Martin family, the strange circumstances surrounding their disappearance, and the mystery that remains. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy. Here in studio with Coin 6 News anchor Jeff Gianola. Jeff, you've been reporting on news in Portland for almost 40 years. It's good to have you on the Coin Podcast Network.
Yeah, Ian, I'm excited to share this story with everyone.
Jeff, you and I have been working together for several years now, and we've had a lot of discussions about a lot of the stories you have worked on. This story about the Martin family is different for you. When you talk about it, you get a different look in your eyes. You say it haunts you. This is one story you are almost obsessed with.
That's true, Ian. It has all the elements of a mystery that still hasn't been solved. A family of five that went for a Sunday drive and disappeared. A detective who believed they were the victims of foul play. And yet, as he uncovers more and more clues, there's one problem. No one is listening to him. In fact, they want him to stop his investigation.
Jeff, let's hop in our time machine here and go back 60 or 65 years. What do we know about Portland in the late 1950s?
Well, Portland was a very different city then. It was an industrial city, wood products, paper mills, a polluted river running through the middle of the city. But the neighborhoods were wonderful places to raise a family. And our family in this story, the Martins, lived in a very stereotypical 1950s neighborhood. And Ian, it was not too dissimilar to what you saw glorified on TV shows of that time, like Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet.
And from one of those quintessential American neighborhoods of the late 1950s, a father, a mother, and three little girls vanish. And with that, let's begin our story.
Part one, Into the Water.
Wake up, Portland. It's a wonderful day today.
It was Sunday, December 7th, 1958, and Christmas was in the air. And the one thing we know about the Martins, this is a family that loved Christmas.
They didn't just decorate their house, they decorated the whole street.
Well, J.B. Fisher is as fascinated with the Martin case as I am. He recently wrote a book on the Martins called Echo of Distant Water. Paint a portrait, if you will, of the Martin family, and let's begin with the parents.
So Ken Martin was 54 years old. He was a co-owner of a Portland home appliance repair company, and he was also active in his community. He was a Boy Scouts troop leader. He was a photography enthusiast. He even had a dark room in his basement. And then there was Barbara Martin, who was 48, and she was a homemaker. She was also really active in community and church groups, and she was really interested in sweepstakes contests, and she was amazingly successful at them.
She even won the family a car.
She won them a Jeep Willys. They ended up trading it in for the station wagon that we'll be hearing more about.
We said that the Martin family loved Christmas. Ken Martin really loved to decorate.
Yeah, their street was actually called Candy Lane over in Northeast Portland, and it got that name because Ken was really fond of dressing up as Santa Claus, having the neighbor kids over. A few years before, had started to make plywood candy canes, about 4 foot tall wooden candy canes that he distributed to all the houses on the street.
And the Martins also had three daughters.
So the oldest was Barbie. She was 14, followed by Virginia, who was known as Jenna, who was 12, and then Susan, who was 10. Girls who went to school in the neighborhood, the younger two went to the local school, Rose City Park. The older daughter, Barbie, was a freshman over at Grant High School, and they were really active in their community.
In 2008, while working on my documentary about the Martin family, I talked with neighbors who grew up with the Martins. Pam Gunderson was friends with the eldest daughter, 14-year-old Barbara.
Now I call her Barbie because I played with her. So Barbie and I used to play together, and Lou and Linda Ellis, and we'd all ride bikes and just play in the neighborhood. I mean, it was wonderful. I just remember that they were very into the neighborhood, like the candy canes on everybody's door, you know, at Christmas. And these wonderful backyard skits that we do. And so we perform for our folks and everybody in the neighborhood. It was just so fun.
It's odd, but we seem to vividly remember brief flashes of moments from her childhood. Pam recalls making lunch with Barbie one day.
Barbie and I remember she came over to the house one day, and I was fixing myself a sandwich. And she says, okay, well, I want a tomato sandwich, so I'm going to go to my house when you finish your sandwich. It was summertime. The tomatoes were on, and she made the most wonderful tomato sandwich. It's always been a memory. Barbie was a fun gal.
The Martin neighborhood, the kids, the families, really seemed very much like 1950s America.
It was a really family-oriented neighborhood. There were lots of kids on the block, and one thing I learned in doing research was that the Martins actually hosted a lot of activities and events in the neighborhood. They put on a lot of plays and pageants, not just at Christmas, but at other times of year. I also learned that Barbara Martin had perhaps one of the first freezers on the block, so kids would come over for popsicles quite often.
So they were a popular family.
They were. They were a popular family, and some of the other families that are mentioned at times in the coverage of their story are referred to as camping partners of the Martins and other kinds of groups that they were involved in. They were real active.
Sue was in the same grade as I was. Virginia was in the same school and a couple of years old.
There was a neighbor boy named Dan Portwood who went to school with two of the Martin girls. And Dan would later become a police detective. And he has a lifelong connection to the Martin mystery.
This kind of thing just really didn't happen. It was always a mystery to me as I grew up. Like I say, Sue was in the same grade as I was. And one weekend, she goes home and never see her again.
The Martins also had an older son, Don. And JB, what do we know about Don Martin?
So Don was 28. He was stationed in the Navy in New York at the time. He was also an art student at Hunter College and Columbia University.
What was his relationship with the family?
Well, Jeff, this gets a little bit tricky. They'd been really close-knit family in earlier years. There are pictures of Don in his scout's uniform. He had been real close with his parents and with his sisters. But Don had had a falling out. He got into trouble and was sent to the East Coast. Unfortunately, it seems that the family grew apart.
We're going to hear more about Don Martin and how he plays into this mystery later in the podcast, but let's get back to that Sunday afternoon. The Martins plan to take a Sunday drive, and what do we know about that drive?
So the Martins had had relatives over that Sunday morning and had told them they were going to go, quote, up the highway to collect Christmas greens, like ferns and pine boughs. And up the highway in that time period referred to the Columbia River Highway. The neighbors recall them getting ready to leave sometime in the middle of the day and then recall them leaving between about 1 and 2:30 p.m.
And when we say they were taking the trip, this was the whole family.
This was the whole family, the three girls and the parents.
What do we know about the car that they were traveling in?
The car was a 1954 Ford Country Sedan station wagon, off-white color with red trim. When Barbara Martin won the Jeep several years back, they had traded that Jeep in for the station wagon.
Now, the Columbia River Gorge is east of Portland, and it follows the path of the mighty Columbia River. And one of the first stunning sights you see is Multnomah Falls. You drive further east, you come to the town of Cascade Locks, roughly an hour's drive from the Martins' home back then. Cascade Locks will later provide an important clue in this case. Now, neighbors say they left between 1 and 2 o'clock. Doesn't that seem late for a drive up the gorge, JB? Because it's winter time here in the Northwest Oregon. It gets dark about 4 o'clock.
Yeah, that is quite late. And in fact, the Martins were very careful drivers. They didn't like to drive after dark, according to friends and family. So this idea of leaving at that time, even if they were only going to get Christmas greens and turning right around, it would still take a couple of hours, which would put them right about dusk or later.
Once again, they told everyone they were going to go collect Christmas greens, which wasn't unusual because they love Christmas.
It seemed to make sense. They did that as a ritual every year. Friends and family had a sense of where they had gone just from the places that they tended to go, which were usually in the Columbia Gorge.
But it will be the last Christmas ritual for the Martins. What nobody knows yet, the Martins won't come home this night or any other night. It's late Sunday evening. The Martins' neighbors are sleeping. All is quiet. But they'll soon wake up to the shattering news. Their neighbors, the Martins, are gone. Vanished. Monday morning, December 8th. The morning started out like any other. The milkman making his rounds, mothers making breakfast, fathers headed out the door to work, and kids on their way to school. JB, when did friends and neighbors become aware that something was wrong?
So initially, family members discovered that they were missing Charlotte Dorsey, who was a teacher over at the school that the two youngest daughters went to. Learned that neither of the girls were in their classes, and then she checked over at Grant High and learned that oldest daughter Barbie was not at school. Ken Martin's boss also found that Ken didn't show up for work for an important morning meeting, and then it really wasn't until nighttime that police were contacted.
By the next day, word of the Martins' disappearance becomes headline news in the Oregonian and the Oregon Journal. As days pass, people listen to their radios for any new information. Pam Gunderson grew up with the Martin girls.
It was not good. It was just like Well, has anybody seen or heard anything today? Every day would be, what's new? You turn on the radio and just try and get any kind of information. And nothing was going on.
The Martins told neighbors they were traveling up the Columbia River Gorge east of Portland. Portland is located in Multnomah County. The Columbia River Gorge crosses several counties, and that was a problem. No agency really took charge of the search.
Yeah, there were actually six agencies that got involved in the Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington areas because really no one initially knew where they had gone.
The Martins never told anyone their exact destination. There was no coordinated effort. Were these agencies talking to each other or sharing information?
There wasn't much communication, at least in the police reports that I've seen and in the media coverage. Doesn't seem like there was much.
This lack of communication and organization would continue to be a major problem in the search for the Martins. It had been 2 weeks since the Martins had vanished, and when a new clue suddenly emerged, it came in the form of a gas station receipt mailed to the Martins' home. It showed Ken Martin had purchased gas at a Standard station in Cascade Locks the Sunday afternoon the family disappeared. Cascade Locks is in Hood River County, and armed with this new clue, the county sheriff developed a theory about what happened. And JB, he believed the Martins accidentally backed up and drove into the Columbia River?
Yeah, that was really the primary theory at the time, was that it was an accident, that the family had stopped down at the old government locks at Cascade Locks, which are shuttered, closed down old locks, and that the Martins accidentally drove into the water there.
The sheriff based his theory from a witness who said he saw tire tracks leading into the water, but there was no hard evidence, no proof. The sheriff never saw the tracks. Divers searched the locks but found nothing. Still, the explanation seemed to satisfy investigators. Except for one. A Multnomah County detective named Walter Graven.
He was a dedicated detective. He worked hard on every case and he took every case personally.
Greg Graven is the chief of police in Yamhill, Oregon. He is Walter Graven's grandson. Greg's father was also a police detective. And Greg, when looking at pictures of your grandfather, it's incredible. He looks like a Hollywood version of what a detective should look like.
Imagine back in the 50s, detectives wearing the long coats, the hats cocked a little sideways. You're defining my grandfather.
When it came to the Martins, Detective Graven had a gut feeling that something wasn't adding up. He had learned the Martins had been spotted that Sunday at a cafe in Hood River, about 19 miles east of Cascade Locks. And Greg, when your grandfather verifies this information, he knows the Martins didn't plunge into the river at Cascade Locks.
That is correct.
And Detective Graven knew something else. The Martins weren't the only ones spotted at the Hood River Cafe.
So in media coverage and newspapers, shortly after the disappearance, you start to hear about two ex-convicts, and only one of them really is mentioned by name. His name is Lester Kenneth Price. Later on, there'll be some other important connections to the case, but he's described as an ex-con who had done time in California and possibly other Western states. The other ex-con who doesn't get mentioned by name is described as someone who had known Lester Kenneth Price, who had spent time with him in prison. And later on, in police reports, he's known as Roy Light.
So the two ex-convicts are seen at the cafe with the Martins, and they had stolen a car?
There's a 1951 white Chevrolet sitting on the west side of the highway starting on December 7th. the day the family disappeared. Doors locked, the keys are inside. And later on, that car with California plates is traced to Lester Kenneth Price. Turned out he had driven it up from Venice, California, right around that time.
And because of the stolen car, the FBI gets involved. And it really had nothing to do with the disappearance of the Martins, JB?
It was because the car had crossed state lines and was believed to be stolen and associated with ex-cons, so the feds were actually dusting it for fingerprints.
And there's more. A couple named Kelsey and Doris Knutson tell the FBI they saw the Martin station wagon leaving Hood River about 4:30 at a high rate of speed, driving west back towards Cascade Locks. They later saw it parked in Cascade Locks with two young men standing next to it. JB, it really starts to verify what Detective Graven's instincts were telling him.
It really does, Jeff. One of the things is that the Hood River Cafe, the waitress who had waited on the Martins, who had told investigators that she clearly remembered waiting on them that afternoon, was very clear in when they were there. She said she remembered turning on the floodlight in the parking lot because it was getting dark while she was in the middle of serving them, which puts the timing of this FBI witness report from the Knutsons in exactly the right place. Clara York, the waitress, remembers the Martin family leaving the restaurant, heading west. And then we have this report that says basically the car was seen at a high rate of speed heading out of Hood River, stopped at Trotter's Point, which is where the 1951 Chevy turns up, abandoned, and then again in Cascade Locks with two young men standing next to it.
Were the two unidentified men the ex-convicts? Had they somehow harmed the Martins? No one was putting the pieces together except for Detective Graven. And Greg, when your grandfather finally gets this FBI report on the car, it points to the fact that no one is coordinating the search effort. Your grandfather is the only one putting these puzzle pieces together. It really had to be frustrating for him.
It absolutely was, and he was extremely frustrated from conversations that I heard him speaking with my father about, that there was no communication, there was no collaboration, there was no networking. Anything primarily on this case that my grandfather discovered was because he was doing the investigation himself and would learn later that officials of other organizations already had that information.
Plunging ahead on his own, Detective Graven is about to discover a new clue. The Dalles is a town about 28 miles east of Hood River. In 1958, an aluminum plant sat on a rocky cliff above the Columbia River just downstream from the town. A man walking in the area found tire tracks.
So these were deep tire tracks and wheel ruts in the mud that went off to the edge of a 25 to 30 foot cliff just downstream from the Dalles. There's no return. In other words, the car didn't go back the other way.
Detective Graven takes plaster casts of those tracks, has them analyzed, and they come back as an exact match to the Atlas brand tires the Martins had on their 1954 Ford station wagon. And there was more. Detective Graven found fresh paint scrapings on the rocks where the tire tracks ended.
That was analyzed by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. They were an exact match to the make and model of the Martins' vehicle, the Ford Squire wagon.
Detective Graven is now convinced the Martins' car had plunged into the Columbia River at that exact spot.
From conversations that my grandfather would have with my father about this specific case, my grandfather did have theories that the Martins were met with foul play, that it wasn't an accident, that there was homicidal violence involved.
Who would want to kill the Martins? Did they dispose of the Martins' bodies by pushing the car off the cliff near the Dalles? Detective Graven was making progress in his investigation, But there was one major problem. No one, not even his superiors, were listening.
My grandfather was investigating this case. He was initially investigating a fraud, illegal activity on the Martin's checking account. And then he was told by his administration that should be his focus and nothing else. His administration, as well as other cross-jurisdictional organizations, were involved in this, and there was not any information sharing. There was not the collaboration or the networking that should be involved in this case.
Remember, the Hood River Sheriff, without any hard evidence, had already concluded the Martins accidentally drove into the river at Cascade Locks. Detective Graven was certain the Martins and their car were in the Columbia River below the cliffs in the Dalles. And he believed, based on evidence and clues, the family had been murdered. The car and bodies dumped into the river.
In my career in law enforcement, I do not see this happening now. However, from what my grandfather explained was that there are individuals who are in positions of authority, and when they're making decisions, instead of admitting that they potentially could be wrong, they commit themselves to that theory, and they would stick with that theory instead of being open to other options or circumstances that could potentially have been involved.
It had now been more than a month since the Martins went missing, and just when it seemed like Detective Graven had run out of leads, a man walking in the area not far from where the two ex-convicts had abandoned their stolen car sees something in the brush under a rock.
What he found was a bloody and battered gun.
A bloody and battered gun. And when he traces the serial number on that gun, Detective Graven will uncover another clue. One that will link the gun directly to the Martin family.
Wow, Jeff, here we are several weeks now after the Martin family, Ken, Barbara, and the three little girls have disappeared. And now I can't wait to hear how this gun plays into the story. But more than the gun and this missing family, Jeff, this is turning into a story about a detective's determination.
Ian, it really is. You see how Detective Graven keeps moving forward even though no one is listening to him. But in his mind, he has no choice. He feels he's near a breakthrough that can solve this case.
And now as we look ahead to part two, Jeff, what other clues are going to float to the surface here?
Well said, Ian. Fate and circumstances often play a role in solving a mystery. And when a barge pulls up anchor on the Columbia River, what happens confirms Detective Graven's suspicions that the Martins' car, along with their bodies, were dumped into the river off that rocky cliff in the Dalles.
Thanks, Jeff. We will talk to you again before part two.
Thank you for listening to this presentation from the Coin Podcast Network. Here's another podcast you might want to check out right now.
March 31st, 1989. And when I got to the top of the stairway, gunfire just erupted immediately.
There's a lot of aspects of Andrew Sled's story that resonate in a lot of the headlines today.
And then he kneeled on my chest and he put his gun to my head and he said, "I should blow your effing brains out."
So I ended up calling Andrew the following day. I heard a story I couldn't believe I'd never heard before.
And he said, "We're the police." And I said, "I didn't know you were the police." And at that point, I think they were pretty quickly realizing that they had made a horrible mistake.
And in many ways, Andrew Sled's story goes unnoticed and untold outside of his friends and family for the last 30 years.
Until now.
You can listen to more great Coin podcasts on coin.com/podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Please listen, download, subscribe, and review.